This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. You may have heard on NPR and other news outlets that over the next 3 years, drones will be flying in public airspace, including eastern North Carolina. These unmanned aircraft, controlled by an operator on the ground, can be huge, having the same wingspan as a 747 jumbo jet, or they can be as small as a mosquito. Drones are used in a variety of ways, for military surveillance, police enforcement, search and rescue, and fighting wildfires. Plans are underway to locate a drone testing site in rural Hyde County, approximately 7 miles north of Englehart. Currently, there are two projects under consideration by the FAA. The first is a request to be one of 6 nationally approved FAA testing sites for drones. The other proposal would allow unmanned aerial vehicles to be tested for agricultural applications in Hyde County.
There are no residential areas within the proposed test site area. There are no homes. It's basically an absolutely huge farm.
On Valentine's Day this year, a statement requesting proposals was issued by the FAA. Hyde County is currently in the process of submitting a proposal.
I believe the applications are due within 60 days.
That's Chris Noble with the Office of Economic Development and Planning. She says the flat terrain and sparse population of only 5,000 people make the area conducive to UAV testing.
The thing that makes Hyde County attractive to the FAA are the things that have made us unattractive for other businesses, and that's the remoteness of our area. We are so far apart from any major transportation outlets or major cities that that's often turned industry away.
According to Noble, the proposed testing site in Hyde County would be located at Englehart Airport, about 60 miles east of Washington.
Our airport is currently the least utilized public airport in the state of North Carolina. So by not having that general aviation traffic, where there could be safety issues with having a lot of general aviation in the same areas or testing the UAVs, and I think that is what makes us apart from any other test facility.
Noble says the county is working with Next Gen Air Transportation Center out of Raleigh, an organization approved by the FAA that partners with North Carolina State University to help modernize the national airspace system. Kyle Snyder is the director of NextGen.
We're coordinating real close with the FAA to request this test site and also to get other flying operations going out there. So we should be getting, we're really looking at the month of March and even early April kind of being good times for us to get some of these approvals and to get this proposal pulled together so we really know what it is we're offering and trying to develop.
Snyder couldn't provide specifics on the kinds of UAVs that would be tested at Englehart Airport.
That is a piece of the proposal that we're working on right now.
Information on the impact the proposed testing site could have on the local economy has not been calculated. However, Hyde County's Economic Development and Planning Director, Chris Noble, says businesses that manufacture UAVs would need to build or renovate existing facilities, which would mean construction jobs. There's also a second UAV project in the works in Hyde County. North Carolina State University is currently working in conjunction with the county to apply for a certificate of authorization to conduct drone testing for agricultural purposes. Farming for thousands of years has meant manual labor and low-tech practices, but with the increased use of technology, drones will become integral to the industry. Ron Heiniger is the Extension Crop Science Specialist and Professor of Crop Studies at NC State.
Utilizing surveillance of crops is actually one of the best ways of managing plants because you can compare different responses that are going on in the field. For instance, you can from a surveillance photograph, you can compare where you have good growth with poor growth and then make decisions based on that comparison.
The UAVs, which are about the size of a remote control airplane, would fly at low altitude in a limited area around the airport. With the remote technology, farmers can measure hydrology as well as fertilizer and pesticide levels. They would also be able to analyze thermal images of bacteria on an individual leaf or watch the growth cycle on a day-to-day basis.
The testing facility will be probably primarily testing new models of drones, drones that can stay aloft longer, perhaps more helicopter or hovering type vehicles than, say, the Predator type thing that the U.S. Air Force is using.
NC State has one of the oldest UAV programs in the country. In the beginning, drones were used as a way to teach students about the movement of regular aircraft. Now, 20 years later, professor and associate head of mechanical and aerospace engineering at NC State, Larry Silverberg, says that North Carolina has the potential to become a leading producer of UAVs.
Industry in North Carolina is gearing up on being providers of UAVs for the various folks that benefit from it in the state of North Carolina, the agricultural community, the Coast Guard, our special forces.
While the agricultural drone project could be approved in the next couple of months, we won't know until late fall if Hind County is selected by the FAA as one of the six UAV national testing sites. The possibilities with drone technology and its development in North Carolina may seem limitless. However, there are some major concerns with this new technology, such as privacy, how it would interfere with commercial and military aircraft, and exactly how UAVs would be used. Still, the FAA estimates as many as 10,000 drones will be flying over the United States by the end of the decade. We'll continue to follow this developing industry in North Carolina right here on the Downeast Journal. Tuesday's rain caused a sewer to spill 5,000 gallons of wastewater into a nearby creek in Jacksonville. Stephen O'Connell spoke with the City of Jacksonville's Utilities and Maintenance Superintendent Pete Deaver about the incident and efforts underway to clean it up.
The location was manhole number 948, which is upstream of our Ellis Boulevard lift station. The spill occurred sometime Saturday afternoon. We're estimating between the 5 and 6 o'clock hour in the afternoon.
There were thunderstorms that came through Jacksonville on Tuesday. Do you think the rain made the spill's effects worse?
We recorded 1.5 inches of rainfall, and that compounded the issue. It increased the flows that went through that station almost doubled.
Should anyone living in the area where the spill occurred be worried?
The spill, it entered into Scales Creek, which is a tributary to Northeast Creek. With the rainfall that we had, the plume has already moved downstream, and it is actually dissipated because of the amount of rainfall. It was done is essentially diluted the plume. We are doing the required water sampling. We're pulling 5 samples in specific locations every day until the Department of Division of Water Quality tells us we no longer have to sample, that the sample results are within the normal parameters. Once that is achieved, then we'll stop sampling, but we will be sampling the water every day.
Is any of the wildlife or the waterways in the area in danger of pollution?
No.
You're at the site today collecting water samples. Is there anything that can be done to clean up the spill?
There is nothing else we can do with, as far as, like I said, the rainwater helped to dilute the effluent that reached the waters. We have made some repairs to the manhole where the overflow occurred, and we also did some clearing so we could access and visually see this from the road. Before, you couldn't visually see it from the road. You actually had to walk off the road to see it.
Do you think the sewage spill could cause any long-term environmental impacts?
No long-term environmental hazards, no fish kills, nothing of that sort. It's just a matter of sampling until we reach the normal parameters.
How many sewage spills occur on an annual basis in Jacksonville?
Last year we had 4, and this spill that we incurred on Tuesday is our first spill for this year.
I'm speaking with Pete Deaver, Utilities and Maintenance Superintendent with the City of Jacksonville. Thanks for speaking with me.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
The Downeast Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with North Carolina's Comprehensive Stroke Center at UNC Healthcare, providing specialized care for complex stroke cases. Information at med.unc.edu/neurology.
When America's storyteller invites a few friends over.
Well, I'm a beautiful princess who was turned into an old lady with bad breath.
You know there'll be singing.
I don't want you to sing here. What? You mean the Met?
Yeah, New York. I'm sending you to Minnesota.
And jokes.
You know that plumber is working on a memoir. It's called Eats, Flushes, and Leaves.
Join in the fun this week.
A Prairie Home Companion, Saturday evening at 6 o'clock on all of the PRE stations. This is the Downeast Journal. The Beaufort County Arts Council holds their first Pamlico Writers Conference this Saturday, March 2nd, at the Washington Civic Center. Their keynote speaker is Bland Simpson, a University of North Carolina Chapel Hill creative writing professor and author of 7 books, including the recently released Two Captains from Carolina. The book tells the story of 2 men, one born into slavery, the other a hero of the Confederacy, whose lives could not have been more different, but who, Simpson writes, had remarkable similarities as well. George Olson has this, which originally aired in October 2012.
On the one hand, the stories of Moses Grandy and John Maffitt share much in common.
The thing that these men share is a tremendous devotion and at times single-mindedness to the overarching craft of how to work well on the water.
And on the other hand,
their fates could hardly have differed more.
Bland Simpson, the author of Two Captains from Carolina, which weaves the stories of these two men together in one book. Together may be too strong a word. At no point in their lives did they ever meet or speak, their only commonality being a shared North Carolina heritage and a life on the water. And in the pre-Civil War period, no commonality would likely have been allowed, as Maffitt was a white man in the employ of the U.S. Navy, and Grandy, for much of his life, a slave in the employ of whoever had bought his services. Those contrasts are reflected in how these two men came to decisions about adopting a sailor's life. Bland Simpson reads from Two Captains from Carolina about the tail end of an adventure aboard the USS Constitution, which locked in Maffitt, the son of a well-known pastor, though raised by his uncle, a Cumberland County doctor, to a life on the sea.
Again, heavy weather bedeviled the Constitution. Is one great storm not enough, mused Maffitt? Must we be spared by a late winter nor'easter, only to be shipwrecked now by a springtime English gale? Commodore Elliott mustered every seagoing talent he could bring to bear in threading the needle between ocean rocks and the waves breaking upon the Scilly Islands, pushing through at 9 knots, mainmast twisting and groaning, and a general fear among those aboard ship that she would be dismasted in the night and they would all be lost. Yet they were not. Old Bruin kept up speed and brought them through and then cried out the general order, once all danger was past, splice the main brace. Everyone, including John Maffitt and his young comrades, gathered about the grog barrel, where it was rye for one and rye for all, and the huzzas rang out, and a jolly lot they were again. This is adventure. This is the life, Maffitt reckoned, the one true life for me.
That contrasts with how Moses Grandy viewed his life on the water, initially a chore given him by his masters, but which allowed the slave Grandy some hint of freedom. Bland Simpson reads from Two Captains from Carolina.
Wintertime, wartime, he cared not. In a life and in a world of captivity, he was at last master of something important, his own movements for many days at a time. Cold? What was that? Start early. Start while it was still dark and the hard winter cold had its rough grip upon all these broad, low tidelands, when the moon hung in the night clouds and the Black River seemed frozen to its edges. This was still a cold he could live with somehow. Raise those 2 heavy Bermuda sails and catch the bare breath of wind and move slowly away to the north. In this Cypress freight boat, past the cypress sentinels lining the river's edge, some faintly lit by the setting moon, some silhouetted, and Grandy and his crew, guarded by the very trees, moved upriver like free men. The work may be hard, exposure to the elements may be severe at times, it was, heat and insects at one time of year, and cold and ice, and you know, winter rain and so forth, and another time of year. Still, these men were operating on their own. These black men were operating these boats around the sounds and up the canals and so forth. It's also a very subversive sort of thing to be in a slave culture, to be able to act essentially for much of one's time as a free man. That feeds that fire.
That fire fed Grandy enough that he worked hard to purchase his freedom, and not just once but ultimately 3 times, his first 2 owners cheating him of his purchase and selling him before his final owner was true to his word. That fire also led Grandy, once ensconced in the Northeast, to purchase the freedom of family members and enter the abolitionist cause, a cause that could be seen as a change in his focus. Maffitt likewise saw change in his sailor's career. Prior to the Civil War's eruption, he resigned his naval commission and offered his services to the Confederacy, though perhaps without the fire that led Grandy to abolitionism.
The Lincoln people do not court him to stay in the Federal Navy, and then when he finds out they're going to arrest him, he just gives up, goes south, and he almost doesn't stick with Jeff Davis. He's appalled at what he hears Jeff Davis and Stephen Mallory say. They don't think there's going to be a war. They don't think the Navy is all that important. He sees very quickly that there's just not a strong guiding intelligence behind this Confederate leadership. So he almost leaves. If Robert Toombs had not come after him after Maffitt first met with Jeff Davis, Maffitt would have left. They would have gone to Europe somewhere, probably to England.
Despite his lack of faith in the Confederacy's leadership, Maffitt ultimately became perhaps its greatest naval hero, operating as a blockade runner. But the fire of the Confederacy never really burned in him. His one fire throughout his lifetime was stoked by that early adventure on the Constitution and the months and years on board ship that followed.
He said, even though he had a farm on the mainland there at Wrightsboro, near Wilmington, he said, a waterman, a man of the sea, is not fit for much else. So as far as evolution, I think he felt like that's what he was, and that's what he always had been. He was born at sea.
And what he remained even after the Civil War. He captained a British merchant vessel for 2 years, then returned to the U.S. and his Wilmington farm, where his maritime work continued. He married for a final time and wrote an autobiography. He died in 1886 and was buried in Wilmington. And there again the contrast with fellow sailor Moses Grandy, who could not return to his native Carolina, who traveled in 1843 to speak at an anti-slavery conference in England, then returned to Boston, where his last documented sighting was at a publisher's office, and then nothing. No evidence of his life or death past that event can be found. Bland Simpson reads from Two Captains.
No one would ever know when Moses Grandy lay down for the last time, or what his last words were before he was laid to rest, neither the when nor the where of it. In his life's work, he was first and foremost a sailor, a supplicant depending upon the motions and mercies of wind and water, which still and always abide. From a Pasquotank River ferry flat and the freight boats on the old Dismal Swamp Canal, to the lumber schooners in circuit around the Albemarle Sound, to the blue water ships that took him to the old wine-dark Mediterranean Sea, and then around the world to the East Indies, he was a mariner, and he did what mariners do. Mark it down for all time. Read it as the epitaph for a great man born in Camden County, North Carolina, who lies somewhere in an unmarked grave, its whereabouts known only to the mind of God. Captain Moses Grandy, he sailed.
In lies both markedly similar and dissimilar, those final two words of an imaginary epitaph for Moses Grandy work as well for John Maffitt. Bland Simpson is the author of Two Captains from Carolina, Moses Grandy, John Newland Maffitt, and the Coming of the Civil War, published by the University of North Carolina Press. I'm George Olson.
Bland Simpson speaks this Saturday, March 2nd, during the inaugural Pamlico Writers Conference, sponsored by the Beaufort County Arts Council, at the Washington Civic Center. If you'd like more information, visit the events calendar at publicradioeast.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. As we get the occasional warm day mixed in with the winter cold, folks are starting to look around in their yard and finding, at least for this time of year, an unusual number of scale insects. And they're bringing them into my office for me to identify. So, what is a scale insect? Scale insects are small insects with piercing, sucking mouth parts that they use to attach themselves to different parts of plants. The individual insects may look like oval or rod-shaped bumps or masses of bumps on leaves and stems. They can be white, yellow, gray, brown, or even black. They can cause lots of problems on ornamental trees and shrubs in the landscape. Why are they called scale insects? Well, because each of the insects on the plant is covered with a fish-like scale that protects the insect from, well, natural predators as well as you. There are two major types of scale insects, soft scale and armored scale. The armored scales secrete a hard, lacquered-like covering over their body. The covering is not attached to the scale insect, and if you pry it off the leaf and flip it over, you can see the insect inside. Or at some times in the season, it might be full of eggs instead. Armored scales are usually smaller than soft scales, about 1/16 of an inch. And they don't excrete honeydew, a byproduct of feeding, like the soft scales do. So with armored scales, you don't get a buildup of sooty mold. But more about that later. Some of the armored scale around here, when looked at under a microscope, look exactly like tiny oysters, and they're actually called oyster shell scale. The soft scales secrete a waxy layer over themselves rather than a hard lacquer type layer, and it truly becomes part of their body, so you can't separate them. These soft scales consume large amounts of plant sap and excrete a sticky, sugary liquid called honeydew. This is a byproduct of their feeding. The honeydew drips down and coats leaves and stems of the plant below the insects, and then sooty mold grows there. So often the first sign that people notice of a scale insect infestation is black sooty leaves and stems. Now the sooty mold itself is not a problem and can be washed off, but it is a sign that a problem exists with scale insects. Soft scales range from 1/8 of an inch up to a 1/2 inch in size, although those are very unusual. Now, the life cycle of scale insects differ from species to species, but essentially immobile, legless females lay eggs under their protected bodies and then die. The eggs hatch into tiny pinkish or yellow, immature insects called crawlers that move around the plant looking for a suitable site to eat, secrete a covering, and mature into adulthood. Some may overwinter as eggs underneath the scale. Others overwinter as females, which resume feeding in the spring and then lay eggs and die. The adult males are tiny and winged and live only a very short time. Scale insects obtain food by sucking fluids from the host plant and cause yellowing, stunted growth, and sometimes even branch dieback when the infestation is really heavy. So what do you do if you have a scale insect infestation? Make sure it really is a scale insect. You can identify them yourself with a hand lens or bring them into your local extension office to be identified. If you do have a scale infestation, keep in mind that you really can treat them effectively only in the crawler stage, when those tiny, young, newly hatched immatures are crawling about on the plant. I have actually seen crawler stages of scale insects this year in early February, so now's a good time to look. During that stage, the best treatment is horticulture oil. Read carefully on the label to make sure you apply the horticulture oil correctly for the plant where your scale insects occur. You also can try and prevent scale in the landscape. Keep yourself from over-fertilizing your plants, because plants with lush growth from too much nitrogen are very susceptible to these insects. Go outside, look carefully at your plants. Now's the time to protect your ornamentals, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
I'm Peter Sagal. Did you know that your old car can support Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? And no, I don't mean it waits until you're inside the house, then turns on the Bluetooth to call the station and donate your money. It can't do that, though it does like to prank order pizza for the Volvo down the block. What I mean is donating your car can help pay for shows like mine. So donate your old car and turn it into the programs you love.
For more information on the vehicle donation program, visit publicradioeast.org.
Thanks for listening to the Downey's Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features that you'd like to hear on the Downey's Journal, you can submit them at the Downey's Journal page at publicradioeast.org. And don't forget, you can listen to archived editions of the Downey's Journal or listen to today's local features. That's all at publicradioeast.org.